Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
Well, it's full steam ahead for the transition now. Yesterday in Wilmington, Delaware, President-elect Joe Biden stood at the podium. His new national security team fanned out in a socially distant semicircle behind him.
Today, I'm pleased to announce nominations and staff for critical foreign policy and national security positions in my administration.
The message Biden conveyed to Americans and the world, in words and in manner, was that his White House will be a place of expertise and order. And Biden claimed the world already likes what it's seeing.
In calls from world leaders that I've had, about 18 of them or 20 so far, I'm not sure the exact number, in the week since we won the election, I've been struck by how much they're looking forward to the United States reasserting its historic role as a global leader.
Well, truthfully, that is a debatable claim, as the United States' place on the world stage has shifted. A nation that stepped back from international alliances and agreements, that's currently the global hotspot for the COVID pandemic. And that inescapable, intrusive fact of the pandemic, well, it was evident even in Biden's announcement yesterday, because between each nominee's prepared remarks, a staffer scurried to the lectern to wipe it down. The new Biden team, though, stayed on message. Here's Linda Thomas Greenfield, a 45-year veteran of the State Department and Biden's pick for UN ambassador.
And on this day, I'm thinking about the American people, my fellow career diplomats and public servants around the world. I want to say to you, America is back. Multilateralism is back. Diplomacy is back.
Well, from NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point, and today we will scrutinize Biden's new national security and foreign policy team and the impact of the delayed transition. And joining me first is Tyler Pager. He's with us from West Harrison, New York. He's national political reporter for Bloomberg News, has covered the Biden campaign, and is covering the transition. Tyler, welcome to On Point.
Thanks so much for having me.
And also with us is Aisha Mills, Democratic political strategist and former president and CEO of the Victory Institute, which runs the presidential appointment projects for the LGBTQ community. She's also a former fellow from Harvard's Institute of Politics and former executive director of the Congressional Black Caucus PAC. Aisha, it's great to have you back on the show.
Hi, Meghna. Glad to be back.
So first of all, Tyler, let's start with you. What was the big message that President-elect Biden sought to really transmit yesterday to, first of all, to the American people?
Yeah, I think the message here was that there's going to be a dramatically different approach to foreign policy and national security under his administration. And I think one of the key things that you saw yesterday with the nominees and the selections were that they were pledging to serve the American people and not the president. I think under the Trump administration, a lot of the national security and foreign policy officials talked about serving President Trump. And yesterday we saw, you know, Secretary of State nominee Tony Blinken and Avril Haines, who's tapped to run national intelligence, talk about protecting the American people and speaking truth to power, and telling, you know, President-elect Joe Biden when he's wrong and giving him information that he may not want to hear but needs to hear. And I think that was trying to restore confidence and trust in American institutions in the American public.
Biden talked about not just a restoration, but in fact, he used the phrase reimagine. So here's that moment.
Together, these public servants will restore America globally, its global leadership, and its moral leadership, and will ensure that our service members, diplomats, and intelligence professionals can do their job free of politics. They'll not only repair, they'll also reimagine American foreign policy and national security for the next generation. And they'll tell me what I need to know, not what I want to know, what I need to know.
President-elect Joe Biden yesterday. Aisha, do you see evidence of a team surrounding Biden that could reimagine American foreign policy?
Well, you know, I'll say this. It is exciting to see a restoration to the normalcy with which government is supposed to operate in terms of its seriousness. We are in crazy, peculiar times with regards to COVID, and certainly coming off of the heels of an administration that has done its best to dismantle our role in the world, to dismantle the way that our government functions. So I find comfort personally, and I think it's great for the world to see on display competent people coming together to perform their duties in government in a way that meets the challenges. To your question, though, about whether this is going to be an administration that is transformative and forward-looking and going to kind of upend business as usual, I'm not really sure that we can go there just yet. The reality is that so much has been mangled and so much has been just torn apart by the Trump administration that Biden's charge, which is a big one. I mean, I've got a lot of empathy for the folks in this administration. It's going to be hard work repairing, restoring, just fixing the things that are broken and trying to put the pieces back together again. What makes me nervous as someone who is progressive and who does hope that there's room for the administration to be more forward-thinking instead of just rebuilding or whatever the language is they're using of build back better or something, to actually think about how we can reimagine and evolve in an innovative, progressive way. I care about that. I want us to do that. I'm not 100% confident that we can in the short term because there's so much to be fixed first. And I wouldn't want to put, you know, that deep expectation in the first 100 days that Biden's going to do something remarkably transformative, because the truth is he's got to get us back to where we were in order to then grow from there.
Okay. On the other hand, though, Aisha, those first 100 days, and, you know, we'll have this conversation in the coming weeks and months as well, but it's all been historically seen as the moment to push the farthest for a new administration's agenda. And especially now, given the coalition that the Biden campaign had to build to win the White House. I mean, it seems like this is a very tender moment for the president-elect in terms of messaging sort of what he wants to accomplish.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I believe that this tender moment should be taken advantage of to do things completely differently than we used to. He is assembling what I'm assuming will be the most diverse administration in history, coming off the heels of President Obama, who had the most diverse administration in history in terms of people. For me, though, the policy making thoughts and being inclusive of the differences of opinion that were on that stage with him when he ran in the primary, and all of the coalitions of people that helped get rid of Donald Trump and made Joe Biden the president, hearing those voices reflected, seeing intangible policy shifts, those ideas is going to be crucial in the first 100 days. And the reality is that we know that Joe Biden has been far more of a more business friendly, you know, statesman, government, you know, functioning well with dignity, but as usual, than a lot of the movements that helped elected him would have hoped that his agenda would be riddled with. And so it is going to be interesting to see what happens in the first 100 days. I believe in this administration, and so I don't want to set them up for failure in terms of having outrageous expectations of them coming in and shifting the entire game of our democracy in 100 days. But I do think you are absolutely right. There will be a lot of us who will be extremely disappointed if we don't see some far-reaching pushes towards some of the more progressive ideas. It'll be interesting to see how Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren are helping to inform any of the work of this administration, too.
Right. So it makes me wonder if evidence of the Biden administration's embrace of those progressive ideas might come in other cabinet picks, because national security and foreign policy are kind of their own thing. Now, Tyler, we do have several firsts, right, in what the president-elect announced yesterday. Alejandro Mayorkas, for example, nominated to head DHS, the first Latino and immigrant in that position. Avril Haines nominated for DNI, the first woman that would head the United States, intelligence apparatus. So some firsts there. But at the same time, familiar names, Antony Blinken, John Kerry, amongst them. How much of it during the transition has this been a conversation amongst the Biden team about how to wed both experience with the kind of diversity and far-reaching change that they promised during the election?
Yeah, this has, I think, been at the core of this transition process, at least in terms of the personnel, in trying to create a cabinet that both reflects the experience that Biden wants to portray to the American people in the world, but also make history. And I think that's what you saw with this initial rollout of national security and foreign policy. He's surrounding himself with people he's worked very closely with, many for whom decades. You know, Tony Blinken worked with him when he was chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Avril Haines was also, you know, involved in helping him back dating to 2008. Jake Sullivan was his national security advisor in the White House when he was vice president. And so I think one of the big challenges for the Biden administration is he has such a large network of aides and advisors, and so balancing bringing in the people that have surrounded him for decades while also bringing in new voices and people that can make history as the first in these positions. And I think you'll continue to see that as we move forward with these cabinet rollouts, and also trying to balance the different factions of the party. You know, as you mentioned, about ensuring that there are people that progressives are happy with. And I think these initial rollouts of national security picks, he's so far been able to satisfy, you know, moderates, progressives, even some Republicans, you know, that they're okay with where he is at this point. But to your point, Meghna, that national security and foreign policy is in its own category. So it'll be interesting to see how he continues to try to strike that balance moving forward with some of the more domestic policy positions.
Well, we are talking this hour about the presidential transition, now that we have the first evidence of the kind of team that President-elect Joe Biden wants to surround himself with, even as this transition has been significantly delayed. So we're going to talk a lot more about that when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we are scrutinizing both President-elect Joe Biden's emerging national security and foreign policy team that he announced this week, and scrutinizing the transition, the delayed and hobbled transition that the incoming Biden administration has had to deal with thus far. And I'm joined today by Tyler Pager, who's national political reporter for Bloomberg News. Aisha Mills joins us as well. She's a Democratic political strategist. And let's listen to a little bit of what Vice President-elect Kamala Harris said yesterday about the work that the Biden administration will have to do domestically.
President-elect Biden and I have long known that when we were elected, we would inherit a series of unprecedented challenges upon walking into the White House. Addressing these challenges starts with getting this pandemic under control, opening our economy responsibly, and making sure it works for working people. And we also know that our challenges will require us here at home to overcome those issues that block our ability to proceed.
That's the Vice President-elect Kamala Harris yesterday. Well, Ayesha and Tyler, if you could just sit with me for a couple of minutes. I want to sort of collectively learn a little bit more about what the transition process is supposed to look like and why we have the system we have in the United States right now. So joining us is Martha Kumar. She's with us from Washington. She's director of the White House Transition Project, a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization that studies presidential transition. She's also emerita professor at Towson University and author of Before the Oath, How George W. Bush and Barack Obama Managed a Transfer of Power. Martha, welcome to On Point.
Thank you very much.
So first, let me just get your expert take here. Have we ever had a transition like the one the nation is undergoing right now?
It certainly is different. But on the other hand, in 2000, because there was a court case over the votes in Florida, that transition didn't begin until December 14th. So they only had 37 days, the Bush people only had 37 days for their transition instead of a normal around 75. And they did a lot of work that helped them come in and they had a pretty good start, but they still were missing certain kinds of things that they needed. For example, on national security, they were behind for over 100 days in getting their appointments in, because you have to go through the whole financial disclosure process and go through the national security, that clearance process. So that one was late, and it was damaged in that way. But as far as they're getting a good start, as far as policy was concerned, they did well, because they had a limited agenda during the campaign of things like education, military buildup, tax cuts. And so when Bush came into office, what he did was take those issues that he had highlighted, and then each week he had one of those issues to explore. So the first week was education. And in doing that, he brought together Democrats and Republicans, and he wanted to send the message that he was going to be president of all the people, and brought in Ted Kennedy and George Miller from the House, who were the education specialists with committees.
Yeah, so it's an interesting point. So in 2000, we had a transition that was truncated by almost 40 days, you're saying.
Yes.
But they nevertheless got off to that pretty good start. So point taken about the sort of weekly agenda that President George W. Bush had following January 20th of 2001. But let me ask you, during that truncated transition time, there are the things that we as the public can see that are happening, but then there are also the things that I guess ostensibly are going on behind the scenes, the preparation for the transition, the briefing books, et cetera. And of course, this is separate and apart from the national security clearances and Senate confirmation process that you were just talking about. But what was that happening in the winter of 2000? And do you see that happening adequately now?
It was work. They started very early. I guess it was in 99, he talked to Clay Johnson, who was at that point his chief of staff, and who would later handle his appointments. He talked to him about preparing for transition. Let's prepare as if we're going to win. Go out and talk to people. Talk to the George Shultzes, the Jim Bakers. And Johnson did do that. And then as they got into the campaign, he would tell Karen Hughes, Karl Rove, Joe Allbog, what kinds of things that he was finding, just to make sure they all coordinated. But they didn't need to do anything. Clay was working on that himself, and then gradually it built up, and they focused on personnel, and they had their issues set up, and they knew if they won, those would be the issues that they would discuss. So when James Baker was in Florida working on the recount, Bush was at Crawford, and he brought in people to discuss with them the cabinet departments, and he selected his appointees. But they also worked on that rollout and a whole view of he was going to move forward, mm-hmm. that he was going to talk about governing, not talk about the election. And when he came in, he did that. He never talked about the election, as Trump was fixated on it and looked backward when he came in. Bush looked forward, and the difference was that even though he had fewer votes than Gore, in his first Gallup poll rating, it was a job approval of 57%.
Mm. So, Martha, hang on here for a second. Tyler, since you have been covering the transition thus far, let me just turn to you briefly. What do we know about the level of contact or communication that before this week, when the official machinery finally kicked into gear with the GSA signing off, et cetera, about the contacts that were actually happening between Biden's transition team and different agencies in the Trump administration? Because I was under the impression that there had been this sense that the Trump administration wouldn't even talk to the Biden team.
Yeah, that's correct. Before the GSA ascertainment, they were prevented from having official lines of communication with federal agencies. You know, I think one of the ways that they worked around that to a certain extent was the people that are advising Joe Biden and have been are all mostly former government officials who are friends with a lot of the civil servants, career officials in some of these agencies. So there were, you know, informal lines of communication. But for the most part, there was really a blockade in terms of the Biden team being able to get any information on things like real-time data about COVID infections, about, you know, the plans that the Trump administration has been making for vaccine rollouts. You know, some of the sources that I've talked to involved in the transition said they just started going to governors and mayors in cities and states around the country to try to gather information about things like state stockpiles, because they couldn't get information about federal stockpiles of supplies. And they've also been relying on some of the companies involved in, and I'm talking here particularly about COVID, involved in vaccines and distribution to try to get a better picture. But you're right, there was really limited contact between the transition effort and the government until this ascertainment, which just happened this week.
Hmm. So, Martha Kumar, take us back here and explain, why is it that we even have this Presidential Transitions Act of, 1963, if I'm remembering correctly? Why was there the need to codify the rules around an orderly transition in this country?
In the post-World War II period, there was a view that that now that you had such large wars with atomic weapons, that you needed to have a preparation for national security reasons and for policy reasons as well. And Truman was one of the first ones to really think about what a transition should be. In March of 1952, he decided he was not going to run again. And so he pulled his staff together in March and said that whether it was going to be a Republican or Democrat, I don't want them to face the kind of thing that I faced when I came into office in 1945, completely unbriefed and unprepared. And so he said he wanted to have a smooth transition. And to that end, in the summer, after there were the party nominations, he wrote Stevenson and Eisenhower and asked them to come into the White House. And they would come in for the day, get a CIA briefing, have lunch with the cabinet, and then in the afternoon talk with the White House staff. And Stevenson did it. Eisenhower turned him down. But they did cooperate on the CIA briefings. And in 62, there was legislation that Kennedy sent in. Actually, it was part of campaign legislation. And that's what, because the campaigns were the ones who funded transitions. Mm-hmm. And the notion was that it really was time for the government to fund it. And one of the sponsors of the legislation was Dante Fussell from Florida. And he said he looked back to the Eisenhower and Kennedy transitions and Truman earlier, that these were ones where you had cooperations between the two sides and they had access to information. And that really is what is underneath that presidential transition legislation from 1963 forward. And Fussell said that while these administrations had willingly cooperated with one another, he said that you could imagine situations without that cooperation. Mm-hmm. Mm. Quote, especially if the incumbent was defeated by the president-elect in a hard-fought campaign. Let us guard against the possibility of non-cooperation, as remote as it may be. And so they wanted to make sure that that didn't happen. So what they did is provide office space and resources with the General Services Administration. And then gradually it's broadened out to the resources given after the party nominating conventions, not even waiting for the election. And it's instead of it's just GSA, it's all of government. And the president is required to do certain things. So, for example, the way that they've gotten all the materials together that now the Biden people can have is as of 6 months before the election, the president is required to create a White House Transition Coordinating Council. And that council establishes transition policy. And then the policies are carried out by the Agency Transition Directors Council, which is made up of the 15 representatives of the 15 departments and seven agencies. And the people who sit on these are career people. Mm-hmm. And they then put together the materials that call for information on budgets, programs, what are the hot issues. And so they can get a fairly quick brief from the departments. But they also need not only the materials, they need to go into the agencies and talk to people.
Right.
That's where you really are going to get the full story.
I'm just going to jump in here for a second, but Martha Kumar, director of the White House Transition Project, a nonpartisan nonprofit organization that studies presidential transitions. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, Aisha Mills, we've just got a couple of minutes before we have to take our next break here. And I just wanted to hear your thoughts. Obviously, there's a long history about why we felt the need to really put how a transition is supposed to operate into law. And Martha's scholarship also shows us that presidential transition acts have been actually updated over time. I wonder if you think it, based on what we have seen during this transition, if it's time for yet another update to further guarantee an orderly transition of power in following future elections.
Yeah, you know, I still appreciate Martha's work because I think with the average American doesn't quite get how serious the transition process is and how nuanced our bureaucracy is. And so making it plain, I think, is really helpful for us all to recognize how critical it is that the systems continue to work. And yes, I personally believe that we have got to find a way to better enforce all of these great statutes, policies, rules, and customs that are on the books for a transition. Because what we saw with the entirety of the Trump administration is that the United States of America is very thoughtful and has spent now centuries considering our democracy, our Constitution, evolving it as the times require, and constantly working to perfect it. But what we don't have in place are real levers for accountability with regards to that. So even with the president, there is a statute that says the president cannot self-deal while he is in the White House. He cannot use his role to enrich himself. Donald Trump did that. And even though it was against the law, there was no real immediate mechanism to hold him accountable for that. Same thing, you know, there are a billion examples of this. The same thing with having political activity coming out of the White House. There is a longstanding law on the books that says that the president cannot have a political activity coming out of the White House.
Well, we are talking about the presidential transition thus far, especially as President-elect Joe Biden begins to assemble his national security and foreign policy team around him. I'm joined today by Tyler Pager, national political reporter for Bloomberg News, and by Ayesha Mills, Democratic political strategist. We'll have a lot more with them in just a few minutes. But as we head into the break, I want to let you know that next week, we're going to be talking about the specific challenges that families who are experiencing homelessness are facing right now with remote learning, as more and more school districts across the country are forced to close their doors again. So are you an educator who works with students who are facing homelessness, or is that you and your family? Yourself, tell us your story at 617-353-0683. 617-353-0683. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
Hi, On Point listeners. I'm poet and author Shinyi Pai. As you celebrate Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I invite you to listen to the 10,000 Things podcast from KUOW and the NPR Network. 10,000 Things is a podcast about modern artifacts of Asian American life, ordinary objects that tell extraordinary stories and reveal something profound about the experience of being Asian in America. Find 10,000 Things from KUOW and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we are scrutinizing the transition thus far, especially in light of the fact that this week, President-elect Joe Biden announced the first members of his national security and foreign policy team. I'm joined today by Tyler Pager. He's national political reporter for Bloomberg News. Ayesha Mills joins us as well. She's a Democratic political strategist. And Tyler and Ayesha, just hang on here for a second, because I want to play another point of view here, because we spoke with John Bolton, who served as President Trump's national security advisor from 2018 to September 2019. He then later published a book called The Room Where It Happened. And of course, you might recall that John Bolton refused to testify during President Trump's impeachment trial. But at the same time, he's also served Republican presidents for decades and worked on five presidential transitions. And Bolton told us that the national security part of a transition, he believes, is always the most important part.
Because much of the information that the new team needs to have is classified. These are complex issues, and even for people who have followed them as scholars or commentators or practitioners, it's just not the same thing as being on the inside. So it doesn't happen automatically.
Bolton also noted, as we heard Martha Kumar talk about earlier, that the Senate confirmation process and receiving those national security clearances can take many months. So there's this drawn-out process here that's an issue. Then he also said,
so if the transition doesn't get started on time, the incoming administration can't pick its people. So it doesn't benefit the country when there's a gap in the transition or the transition's not smooth. It's not a question whether you agree with the policies of the new team or not. It's a question of whether they're ready to go at what might be a crisis that begins 5 minutes after the new president's sworn in. The fact is, every day you lose is a day you never get back.
Also a fact, it's the current administration, the Trump administration, that has been standing in the way of the transition to the new Biden administration having begun earlier. So given that, what kinds of threats does John Bolton worry about regarding the threats that America's adversaries might pose?
I don't think the risk is of a direct confrontation with the United States. I don't think it would be a risk over a huge issue of American national security. I think it would be our adversaries, Russia, China, Iran, North Korea, terrorist groups, you name it, Venezuela, taking advantage of what they know is the diverted attention of Washington during the transition period to advance their interest in ways that are not existential, but which put the U.S. and its friends and allies in a more difficult position than they would have been absent the transition.
That's John Bolton, former U.N. advisor, former national security advisor in the Trump administration. Now, Tyler and Aisha, what I wanted to ask you is the message that President-elect Biden gave regarding his administration's view, or what his administration's view will be, of national security, a more expansive view, because this week, President-elect Biden also announced that there will be a brand new position in the National Security Council, and that position will be headed up by former Secretary of State John Kerry as a presidential envoy for climate. So here is what John Kerry said yesterday, turning to address Biden himself.
You're right to rejoin Paris on day one. And you're right to recognize that Paris alone is not enough. At the global meeting in Glasgow 1 year from now, all nations must raise ambition together, or we will all fail together. And failure is not an option.
Aisha, let me start with you. Your thoughts about climate literally having a chair at the National Security Council.
That's perfect, and I'm thankful that incoming President Biden recognizes that literally our climate is probably the biggest threat to our security around the world. And it's fitting to have someone like John Kerry, who has such a breadth and depth of experience in diplomatic relations, to be the person that is spearheading that.
Tyler, your thoughts about the inclusion of a new presidential envoy for climate?
Yeah, I think, you know, I traveled with Joe Biden over the last 18 months all over the country. And one of the most, I think, effective arguments that he had about climate change was that it is not a problem America alone could solve. And you'll remember that during the primary, he came under a lot of fire from progressives for not supporting the Green New Deal and the very ambitious climate plan pushed by, you know, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and the left flank of the party. And one of his points was, you know, we only contribute to 15% of the global emissions. We need to lead the world in marshaling our efforts to contain and fight back against climate change. And so I think this appointment of John Kerry perfectly aligns with that argument he was making throughout his presidential run, is that America needs to be a voice of leadership around the world about fighting climate change. And Kerry was the one that was a key architect of the Paris Climate Accords, as you know, we heard him mention in that clip you just played. And so he is the person with the experience, and climate change has been kind of his calling since he left, you know, as when he was Secretary of State, but particularly since he's left that posting, he's been a very vocal leader on the need to address the issue. So it makes sense that he would take on this new role with heightened importance under a Biden presidency.
Right. And so, I mean, this is one of the things that I think, regardless of one's political views, a modern democracy in the 21st century does need to have a more expansive view of what qualifies as a national security issue, right? I mean, climate, the health of the domestic economy, justice, the modernization and strength of the military as well. I think, I mean, Aisha, I feel like we're just overdue for a rethink about what are the factors that go in to having a truly secure nation.
Thank you so much for making that point. You are so spot on. And I have to add to the list that you just laid out for everyone, white nationalist terrorism and domestic terrorism as the greatest threat to our national security here at home on our shores. The FBI wrote a report listing out the fact that white nationalist domestic terrorism was a major threat, and nothing has been done about that. And so, yeah, I 100% agree with you that the era of, you know, frankly, Republican thinking about war, the warmongering kind of, you know, law and order sense of going around and policing the world is not really what our national security threats are. We've got to consider the fact that our natural resources and access to them as it relates to climate change are huge and important, and certainly the threats that we're facing domestically, which have everything to do with hate and violation of human rights.
Indeed. And the FBI and the DHS as a whole, right, in that threat assessment that was released earlier this year, yeah. Chad Wolf saying that white nationalist violence or terrorism is the number one domestic terrorism threat in this country. But so I'm going to come back, though, to one thing here. Joe Biden served as the head of the Senate Foreign Affairs Committee. He was obviously vice president to President Obama for 8 years as the United States continued to engage in foreign military conflicts. Afghanistan continued to turn on during the Obama administration. So I'm not sure we can just hang this sort of focus on war and the military as the means for national security exclusively on the Republicans, Aisha.
You're right about that, and nobody gets a pass. And I was alluding to this earlier when I said that, you know, Joe Biden is a guy who has a history. He's been around a long time. And whether or not we move progressively forward with a lot of this and have a transformation of government rather than just a stabilization remains to be seen, because so many people, including myself, are expecting that we have a much bigger push and progressive lens on how we do things. And a lot of people, Biden himself, were sitting around when things were going awry and helping to foster some of that, like the crime bill, for example, that we need to undo. So I absolutely.
Well, I want to spend the last couple of minutes looking forward a bit as much as we can. And in order to do so, let's listen again to a little bit of what the president-elect said yesterday about the diversity of the team he's assembling around him.
While this team has unmatched experience and accomplishments, they also reflect the idea that we cannot meet these challenges with old thinking and unchanged habits. For example, we're going to have the first woman lead the intelligence community, the first Latino, an immigrant, to lead the Department of Homeland Security, and a groundbreaking diplomat at the United Nations.
And Vice President-elect Kamala Harris promised that the Biden administration would pick a cabinet that, as she put it, looks like America.
Today's nominees and appointees come from different places. They bring a range of different life and professional experiences and perspectives. And they also share something else in common, an unwavering belief in America's ideals.
That's the vice president-elect. Now, one more perspective here, because Democratic Congressman James Clyburn of South Carolina, one of Joe Biden's closest allies, let it not be forgotten that Clyburn was instrumental in saving Biden's campaign in South Carolina. Well, Clyburn was on CNN yesterday talking about the fact that he thinks the Biden administration should include a marquee member of the progressive wing of the Democratic Party.
I wish he would come into the administration. Bernie has a way of getting people to understand certain things. So I think that we are a big tent. We are a tent big enough to hold young people and some not so young people.
Tyler Pager, is there any indication, any murmurings from the Biden team that that might happen?
So yesterday, Joe Biden participated in an interview with Lester Holt and was asked this question, and he seemingly threw cold water on the idea of plucking Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren out of the Senate, referencing, you know, how slim the majority is for Republicans at this point, depending on what happens in Georgia. And the fear that he has about taking out key leaders in the Senate who he feels he needs to pass progressive proposals through the Congress. So I think there is definitely a lot of push from progressives to see someone like Bernie Sanders end up in the cabinet somewhere like Secretary of Labor. But I think Joe Biden is particularly concerned about plucking people out of the Senate, particularly someone like Senator Sanders, who, you know, the home state governor is a Republican. Though the governor said he voted for Joe Biden and would appoint someone in the line of Bernie Sanders in terms of political ideology, it is a risk that Biden would be taking to lose a member of his own party in the Senate when it is so closely contested there, and he's going to have enough battles with Mitch McConnell as it is.
Okay, so speaking of how closely contested the Senate is, Aisha, we have a listener on Twitter, Kate Eads, who says, we're ignoring the elephant in the room that until after January 5th, Biden must continue to appear moderate because Democrats have to win in Georgia. Your thoughts?
My thoughts are that Democrats do not necessarily win when we pretend that we are gray and that we've got to stand for something or we'll fall for anything. And frankly, it was the movements that were fueled by progressive energy that ushered in a Biden administration. And it was black and brown people who are the base of the party that lean a little more progressive that helped to usher in a Biden administration. And so it was, and we lost a lot of white women, frankly, more so than last time. The idea that there is a conservative base that is fueling the Democratic Party is just not true. And we need to win Georgia. We need to win the Senate in Georgia. And that is about engagement, turnout, and animation, more so, in my humble opinion, than a gray area of trying to be Republican light in order to get some people to vote for Joe Biden.
That Ossoff-Perdue race, though, one of the two in the Georgia runoff situation that we've got was so very close. I mean, there's still, and this is Georgia we're talking about. I mean, John Ossoff, couldn't it only help him to be able to peel off just as many voters as he can who might be in that gray area, as you say, Aisha?
I believe that Stacey Abrams did an amazing job over the years of getting Democrats to turn out. Now, the truth is Donald Trump being at the top of the ticket really, really, really animated that turnout more so than, you know, than not. And so, yes, the question becomes in Georgia, you know, Georgia lost in the state legislature, went even more conservative just as they were electing Joe Biden. So there is that to navigate. But I believe, and the data shows us, that when more Democrats, actual Democrats, show up and vote, Democrats win. And that is different than trying to get a couple of Republicans to conservatively cross a line by making Joe Biden be a, you know, gray area in the middle. I think the game is turnout, getting people in animated to come out and to vote. That is how the Democrats are going to win the Senate.
Well, Tyler, we've just got just a minute, less than a minute to go here. I'm wondering if you have an inkling about the next names or cabinet positions that Biden might reveal in the coming days or possibly next week.
Yeah, so I think that next week we're going to see some economic positions in the cabinet. You know, we've reported that Janet Yellen will be tapped as the first woman to be Treasury Secretary. And so I think we'll see a build out of the economic team. Another position that was not filled yesterday or not announced yesterday was Secretary of Defense. You know, there's reporting that it's Joe Biden has not yet made up his mind for that position, though the front runner seems to be Michelle Flournoy. So I think we'll see, you know, the focus early next week after the Thanksgiving holiday be on the economic team. And then shortly behind that, I think we'll see some top health officials, obviously in the middle of the pandemic. That's a focus as well.
Well, Tyler Pager is national political reporter for Bloomberg News. We've got links to his reporting at onpointradio.org. Tyler, thank you so very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Aisha Mills, Democratic political strategist, former president and CEO of the Victory Institute, and former executive director of the Congressional Black Caucus PAC. Aisha, it's always great to have you on the show. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can Profit Motive Save the Planet? Is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.